Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 21, delivered on April 5, 2016. The title of this lecture is Securities Risk.
Today, a securities risk. Before I do that, you might have noticed that I gave you a little more time for Chapter 8's assessments. I was having a few students sending me letters about slashing my tires on my car on the homework. There was one that was particularly evil, and I'm going to show it to you. You'll obviously get the right answer to it if you want to go back and do that homework over again. But like I said, I extended the deadline for the Chapter 8 stuff. But there was one in those problems, you might have remembered, where there was an attorney who could take $49,000 as an upfront retainer and work for this company, law firm, for a year and give up, as a result, her billable hours of $545 an hour for 8 hours a month. Do you remember that problem? Okay, I was just scanning through, and there were more than a few people who didn't get it right. I had a few people send me hate messages, so I thought I'd show you how to do that one in class here. It's actually quite a sophisticated problem. Honestly, every semester I forget that problem's there. One of these days I'm going to delete it, but every time I want to think about deleting it, I say, nah. Let me show it to you. Technically, actually, this is a problem that I would throw at students in the next class up from this, which is 341, Finance 341. It'd be an early one to see if they really are finance thinkers. But you remember the context of the problem was that there was an attorney who could take a $49,000 retainer up front. In so doing, she would give up 8 billable hours a month for a year at $545 per billable hour. And they want to know, now the net present value, they gave you the cost of capital, I think it was, I've got it right here, it was 15%. But they want you to find the internal rate of return. And the real problem with this, and you probably wouldn't think about it right off the bat, is that this was a monthly cash flow stream. Watch how I do this. Watch and weep, good citizens. So now, and this is actually kind of a reverse, because the cash flow up front is the positive one. So we're going to reset. And we're going to say cash flow, the original cash flow, what she gets is positive $49,000. Okay? And then we go down. Now, cash flow one, she's going to give up $545 an hour for 8 hours a month. Which, let me try to do that because I'm not even going to try that myself. $545 times 8 hours per month. So she's giving up $4,360. Okay, so $4,360. This is an opportunity cost, so this will be negative. And she's going to get this, the frequency is 12 times. Enter. Now let's go down. Now what we're going to do is we're going to say, all right, compute the internal rate of return. And the internal rate of return is 1.02329%. You think, well, thank God that's over with. That's got to be the answer. Wrong, cash flow breath. This is a monthly. So you have to turn this into an annualized. Do you remember that trick for annualizing a monthly interest rate or anything like that? I would have to take 1 plus this interest rate as a decimal to the 12th power minus 1. And you're saying, watch, it's 1.02329. So I'm going to pull this calculator up, a normal calculator. 1.02329, but that's a percentage, so I got to turn it into an actual number. So the monthly internal rate of return is 0.012329. We'll add 1 to that, and then we're going to raise it to the 12th power for 12 months. And then we're going to subtract 1 off it to get it back to a percentage. Annualized, that's a 12.99% internal rate of return. Annualized. Now, let me go through that again. Whenever you have, and this actually does have a somewhat practical application, to the extent that sometimes you'll buy securities instruments that are not exactly a year, in years. Like a great example is a 3-month T-bill. If I took, let me show you one real quick here. Let me show you. Let me flip this over to the document camera here for a second. A 3-month T-bill, you buy it, and 3 months later, it pays you $1,000. So let's say that you bought it for $995. You remember the face value of 3 months later, you get the face value of it, $1,000. You follow that? Okay, that's the stuff we did early on. So in other words, your 3-month return would be the $5 interest you earned over the $995 you invested. But again, that's a 3-month return. Well, let me honk that out on the calculator here. $5 divided by $995 equals point. So in other words, your 3-month return is about 0.5%. Okay? But that, we usually talk about things annual. So we have to annualize this 3-month return. To annualize anything, the first thing you have to do is take the decimal representation of the percentage, add 1 to it. That's always going to do that. And then I'm going to raise that. How many 3-month periods are there in a year? 4. So to the 4th power equals, now we take the 1 off again. So the annualized rate of return on that 3-month T-bill was about 2.03%. That's how you annualize any interest rate that's a part of a year. Technically, what you're doing is it's 1 plus the interest rate as a decimal. And then you take that to the 1 over the number of years. You remember I showed you this? So with the 3-month T-bill, what I'm doing is I'm taking it 1 over 3/12 of a year. For the one that I just did there with the attorney, that was 1 over 1/12 of a year. 1 over 1 over 12 is 12. 1 over 3 over 12 is 12 over 3, which is 1. You remember that trick, division is same as multiplication by reciprocal. And then I minus the 1. Don't ever forget to minus your 1 again. Don't forget to subtract the 1. Always. That's how you annualize any interest rate. Any interest rate. So in other words, suppose, let me do this. Suppose, I'll show you one that would be a little bit more robust. Suppose that you bought a 5-year junk bond. You bought the junk bond for $720. And in 5 years, you're going to get $1,000. Supposing that the thing pays off. Supposing the thing pays off. You pulled in $280 in interest on an investment of $720. So if you do that on the calculator, $280 over $720, that's a 0.5-year return on it is 38.89%. Now let's annualize that thing. To annualize it is 0.3889. To annualize it, I would take 1 plus that 0.3889 to the 1 over the number of years, which in this case is 5 years. So switching back over now. To see the calculator, I'm just going to add plus 1 to that number I got right there, which is probably the best way to do it, equals. And now I'm going to raise that to the 1/5 power, open parentheses, 1 divided by 5. I could have put in 0.2, obviously, equals. And again, don't forget to subtract the 1 at the end, for God's sake, minus the 1. And if I do that, minus 1, 6.79% annualized return on the junk bond. There's my return on it, annualized. And this is the annualization is just so that we can say everything comparing apples to apples as far as returns go on investments. So if it's less than a year, you'd get a number bigger than 1 for the exponent. If it's more than a year, you get some number that's less than 1 for the exponent. But you can always fix. But the real trick there was to see that this, what the calculator here, see this calculator? It doesn't care whether you live or die. And so it's not going to explain to you, this is a monthly, because you weren't able to explain to it that's a monthly return. But one way or the other, going on to finish up the problem, though, the cost of capital, this person's cost of capital, the opportunity cost, is 15%. What you do is you think of that as her hurdle rate. Okay, she has an internal rate of return on this deal, this investment of hers, of 12.99%. Her hurdle rate, the least that she will take on investments, is 15%. So obviously she's going to say no to this deal, because it does not meet the hurdle rate that she wants, that she anticipates. So the internal rate of return is annualized 12.99%, and she would reject this offer because it's insufficient. Her risk profile, you could say it this way, her risk profile indicates that she will accept projects with no less risk than an expected return of 15%. Okay, you follow that? That's not, it is a complicated problem, but as I explain it to you, it begins to make more sense. But having you figure this out up front, there were very few of you who could figure this out up front on your own. And I appreciate that, so please don't slash the tires on my car. Now, there was another one there, too, that had a little twist in it. It was the one, and this was actually based on the actual the actual scenario. It was former President Clinton had a book deal where he was going to essentially, let me flip this over to the document camera, where he was going to take a $15 million retainer and for a book, but that would mean that he would not do speaking engagements for 3 years, and every year he could pull 8.2 mil in speaking engagements. Now his cost of capital, his cost of capital, his hurdle rate is 10.4%. So the question is, first of all, let's do this as a net present value. I think they asked, what's the net present value of this? That part's easy, and I'll do that for you right off the bat. Resetting, your initial cash flow is $15 million, okay? And then we go down, and in exchange, we give up $8.2 million per year for 3 years. Now his cost of capital is 10.4%. Whoops. 10.4%. No, that's not what I wanted that to say. I'm going to have to reset that and do that again because I can see that it was going to do it wrong on me. $15 million up front is your initial cash flow. Enter. Down $8.2 million. Enter. Down 3 periods. Enter. Down. Okay, now, I over Y is 10.4%.
Do you want to make that
negative 8.2? No. Yeah. Yes. No. I said no to myself. You're absolutely right. I was just testing you there to see. Yeah. Okay. He gets $15 million up front. That's cash flow one. And then he surrenders 8.2. Okay. Enter. And then down. 3, enter, down. Now we're going to go over to I over Y, and we're going to put in 10.4, enter, and now we're going to compute the net present value, and it sucks. Has a massively negative NPV. He's giving up way too much in speaking fees for just $15 million in a book. However, there's a second part to the problem. It's the royalties on the book. But the royalties don't start until the end of the third year. So there's a second component to this. So the first thing I'm going to do here is that, well, that's suck.com. Let's try that again. 524944. Negative. That's the negative net present value of the project. If it's just the retainer up front, the money up front, and then giving up his speaking fees for 3 years while he writes the book. But there's another part to it, they say. Well, at the end of year three, starts pulling in royalties. Now, the royalties are going to be the first year out there at the end of year three. We got 0, 1, 2, 3. At the end of year three, out here, you've got $5.5 million. And then every year after that, he's going to get 30% less than the year before. That's a classic perpetuity with growth. You remember that the value up front, as far as stock goes, D1 over K minus G, Well, here it is. Except this one has the bizarre twist in it that the G is a negative number. So in other words, in order to do this one, to get the value right here at 3, I would take $5.5 million divided by the cost of capital, 0.104, minus negative 30%, because the G is negative 30%. That was the twist on the second part of that, is that the growth rate is negative, oddly enough. If I crank that out, if I haul that out, just do that calculation real quick here. 5.5 divided by open parenthesis 0.104 minus negative, which is plus 0.3, close of parentheses, equals $13.61 million at the year 3. So in other words, I have at year 3 a present value of future expected cash flows of an extra $13 million. Which I can then discount back 3 periods at 1 point at 1.104 to the 3rd power. $10.1175 million extra. $10.11752. That's a 10. And lo and behold, that is the new net present value, adding in the present value of the future expected cash flows from the royalties. And in that case, it comes up to be a positive NPV project. That one took a considerable, the step part two, that part with that perpetuity in there, was the part that could have killed you in this one. First of all, seeing that this is just a perpetuity, but then you have to take it back from year 3 to the present and add it to the original NPV. So in other words, this deal sucks if all it is $15 million up front. This deal does not suck at all if the NPV, if you take into account the royalties, if you get those royalties out there when the book is finished. This, by the way, interestingly enough, just as a side light on this, talking about book deals, I'm working with a publisher right now on doing a book of it's a lot of my nice photographs and then these really nice stories about the prairie and all that. Now, the whole deal is they'll give me a little retainer up front, but then when the book's published, I start getting the royalties from it. So, clearly, this is going to be a negative net present value project for me, sitting there on my fat ass, get maybe $5,000 to write and write and write and organize photographs and all of that. But then I get the royalties. So, do you see that cattle prod in there? Get the damn book finished fast, because the faster I get the book finished, the more that the present value of those future expected cash flows from the royalties has impact on it. If it takes me 3 years to write the book, I mean, the royalties are going to not be very valuable to me now. But if I take 6 months, 12 months to do it, then those royalties are going to definitely tilt in favor of this being a positive net present value project. So up front, it's not.
But the faster I get the book finished and they start selling it, I get the royalties, the better off I am as far as a positive net present value on the project goes. Provided it sells more than maybe 10 copies, which is probably what will happen. But anyway, enough of that. Now, let me go on here to today's lecture. This has numbers in it, but believe me, it's something like as complicated as that. But the first thing that I have to do is I have to remind you of something that I've told you over and over again in this class, trying to convince you. Son, you are going to die someday. Okay? You know that. The eternal blackness and all that, and you know, you wake up and you smell something cooking and it's your ass in hell, and all that. Well, there's more to the story than that. You're going to have a life. It's going to have its ups and downs. Sometimes you're going to be healthy. Sometimes you're going to be sickly. Now, I am going to show you your life. What's your first name? This, Michael, is your life. I can't. What's your major?
Marketing.
Nope. Oh, there will be a lot of excitement. Let's calculate some data today. We live, actually, trust me, from being a consultant for many years in a rather, shall we say, less than standardized environment, there's a lot to be said for boredom, seriously. Especially when excitement usually has death and things like that involved in it. But this is your life. You're born. You were born kind of an underweight, sickly kid. And we're going to talk about your health care costs. It started out, it wasn't bad, and a lot of it was because the doctor, when he spanked you to make you start breathing, he mistook your face for your ass. But the healthcare costs were pretty high for the birth. Okay? And things were still pretty expensive for a while, but then you started getting better and everything was good. And then you had those strained carrots that really did nasty things, and but then you had a couple of years that were pretty comfortable, ups and downs. You broke a leg. And you had some immunizations that you had to do. But things were okay. And then you got quite ill, around 8 or 9. And then you started getting good. And then puberty set in. There was the acne thing. And then there was that car accident. And then you got into a couple of illnesses, some of your final childhood illnesses. Then you got into your 20s, and things were actually a lot, your health was improving, so your health care costs were going down. This is something that happens. Do you remember, am I the only one who remembers when you were a kid vomiting a lot and having stomach aches and snot nose and all that? You get through that. A lot of kids, most kids have that early childhood, the illnesses and the problems, and then you begin to develop these immunities, and you're pretty much almost like godlike in your 20s, in your early 20s. You don't get sick that often, and all, and when you do, you just Ralph and go back into the party. So your healthcare costs are going down. But then you get into your 30s. First, there's the high blood pressure. And then you have that first heart attack. Dude, if you hadn't eaten all that Kentucky Fried Chicken, it wouldn't have been like that. And then you started having to buy those little blue pills. And then the diabetes kicks in. You had a couple of good years there, and then you start getting that really big swelling and those nodules. They cut those off. And then you get into your 60s and you're getting the usual illnesses. They have to put some plastic tubes in so you don't pee on yourself. And you have a stroke. You got through it, except that you just kept saying, "Go Cubs." You get into your 70s. You're getting sicker. You got meds that you have to take every day. And then you die. Game over. That's it. Now, I'm going to tell about your life, madam. You were born about the same time as him, but you were, you were born a perfect baby. There were angels singing when you came out. You didn't even dirty your diaper. Well, you did, but you cleaned up after yourself when you were 3 days old. And you were just a very, very healthy child. And you stayed healthy. But there were some ups and downs along the way. You had an accident on your tricycle. It wasn't really an accident. You were aiming at that boy who disrespected you. But then you're fine. Your childhood illnesses are mild. And you're such a perfect baby, they even decided you didn't even need vaccinations because viruses ran away from you. And then in your teens, something quite terrible happened. You found out about something called boys. And then your dad got some shotgun training, and that was over. You had a couple of illnesses in your early 20s. And then you got cancer. That sucked. But you got through that. And then you got a divorce, and your health improved quite a bit until you met that fellow who gave you all kinds of stress. And up and down your life went. You lived a lot longer than that poor son of a bitch over there. But you were still getting sick as you got older. And you finally, you die. But then, you were born. Much later. This guy is actually only like 9 years old. No one knows that he's actually a child genius. They gave him some hormone pills so he'd look like a college student, but he's actually just a kid. So he comes along out here somewhere, relatively healthy baby, has low impact life. He's a very boring child, very bookish. His idea of getting hurt is cutting himself, getting a paper cut on a book. But there was that one incident where he found his dad's gun and he shot himself in the hind leg. But he lives his life healthy and all that. What I'm trying to show you something. This is a principle behind insurance, health insurance. If I take many people of many ages and many different life experiences and different ethnicities and all of that, and I put them together, all of these ups and downs cancel each other out. Because if you'll notice, I drew those so that there is not perfect correlation between the people, the individuals. And that's something that's quite important. As long as they're not perfectly correlated, there will be a slight canceling out of one person with another. Taken over a very large population, this becomes not some volatile line of an individual, it becomes a predictable hum of the insured pool. This is called risk pooling. It is a fundamental principle. If we get enough people together, their individual ups and downs cancel each other out. As long as we have enough people, different ages, different ethnicities, different life experiences and all that, they do cancel each other out. The more, the better. And this is the whole basis. I know damn well what my costs are going to be from year to year. I don't know what yours or any individual's, but I know that the group's cost to the healthcare system will be this. And therefore, I can then charge a premium so that I can cover it and make some money for myself as an insurance company. This is a huge fundamental principle, but it goes way beyond insurance. It is a physics principle. Long time ago, we figured out the principles, many of these principles from the physicists did centuries ago. And a lot of what we do in a lot of business fields, the basic understanding came long, long before any of us were alive. This is one of them. It's part of a whole field called statistical mechanics. And I can guarantee you the math of it is, you get far enough into the math of it, it is just like, oh my God. You get into these things called stochastic partial differential equation systems, which is one of my specialties. What was one of my specialties? In other words, how you price derivatives and stock, because securities, their prices are just volatiles up and down. You put enough of them together and you apply rules of logic and physics and you use the mathematics of physics, you can get the prices of a price of anything. That's the leading edge of the field out there. But for our purposes, and we hear this, see this all the time. I'm going to tell you something right now, and I don't want you to be offended by it. But as a singer, you suck. You're not as bad as One Dimension or One Direction. You're considerably better than Justin Bieber, although you can't twerk at all like Miley. Seriously, don't try to prove that you can to me. Okay, but the point, though, is that most people kind of suck as singers, but you put a bunch of them together, and suddenly it sounds great. Have you ever heard a large choir singing? The individual singers can be terrible, but they cancel each other's suckitude, for lack of a better word, out. This is the whole basis. If you've ever listened to children's choirs, children actually, except for some extraordinarily talented children are not very good singers. But you put a bunch of them together and you've got some of the greatest choirs in the world are child singers in large groups, because they tend to modulate off each other and they create a smooth, lovely sound. Did any of you go to high school here in Normal, Illinois? They've got an orchestra here. They actually, starting in grade 5 or 6, they encourage a lot of the kids to start playing violins and violas and cellos and all that. Well, the first concert that I had to go to for my daughter, I thought, oh God, I am going to need Valium, Ludes, and a bottle of Jack to get through this awful experience. Unfortunately, I forgot in the rush to get her there to take any of those, and I thought, this is going to be the worst experience of my life. You had like 50 kids who had probably been learning the violin for maybe 3 months before they did this, but I'll be damned if it didn't sound pretty good. Individually, when you hear one of them, you know, cats over in the next neighborhood would kill themselves and things like that. But when they started playing all together, their awfulness canceled each other. Each of them had awfulness, and the awfulness canceled each other out, and it sounded pretty darn good. And this was actually very encouraging, because the kids realized that I understand now I'm not as bad as I thought I was, as long as I never have to play on my own. And it encouraged them to keep going and all that. Okay, what does this mean for finance? It means that when you are constructing a portfolio, the whole point of building a portfolio is so that the individual stocks cancel out each other's quirks. Companies themselves, any individual company, will have its stock price going up and down for a lot of reasons that are just because of that company, or because of a certain group of companies or a certain part of the country in which the company is in. So, if you were to buy just that company's stock, you are bearing a lot of volatility, a lot of risk you don't need to have. Because there, if you put more companies into the portfolio, all of those quirks, those individual diversifiable volatilities would go away. That's why there is no market in the world that's going to reward you for holding a single stock. Because you're holding a lot of risk you just don't need to be holding. And no one's going to pay you for that. So the trick, though, is that you have to keep your eye on how you build the portfolio. The stocks in it. Obviously, you have to look at the beta. Keep the betas in a range where they're commensurate with your risk tolerance. But the other thing is to keep your eye on the portfolios, on the stocks' correlations with each other. In other words, if you keep putting in stocks that are highly correlated with each other, building your portfolio that way, you're not going to get rid of that diversifiable risk. You want stocks that don't correlate very well with each other. And that way, they're the one going up, the other will probably be going down a lot more. But if they're perfect, if they're well correlated, highly correlated, they'll be going up and down together. You don't want that. You want them to cancel each other's quirkiness out. And so what I want to show you here, and there are a number of services that do this. Well, that sucked. One of my favorites here, and I can actually get this off the board now, get away from the ugly part of today's party. The place I'm going to show you here is called PortfolioBuilder.com. And again, there are other sources like this. You can put in stock symbols and look at how the stocks correlate against each other. Now, the classic one, and I don't know, you'll have to tell me this, and I can't remember, I ask this every semester. In your stats class, did they introduce you to what's called the correlation coefficient? Technically, it's called the Pearson correlation coefficient, and it's designated by a lowercase Greek letter rho, the R. It's not that hard to calculate. My God, you can give Excel two data sets and say, calculate the Pearson correlation coefficient, and it'll give it to you in a split second. You can calculate it yourself and maybe have time left in your life to die. I remember we had to do those by hand, and boy, it's a lot easier these days. There are other correlation coefficients. There's one called the Spearman correlation coefficient. There are a couple of beyond that. But the one that is classically used is the Pearson correlation coefficient. Let me show you. What I'm going to do here is, well, first of all, let me get in a start date. Let's do a start date, the beginning of the year. And let's do an end date, the end of yesterday. We'll just do that one. Okay, now I'm going to put in some stock symbols. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at the correlation coefficient between the pairs of the stocks in the portfolio that we're proposing. So, in order to do this, let me throw in just a whole bunch, and you can offer one too. I'm going to put in Target, Netflix, General Motors, Nordstrom, Microsoft, Google. You don't have to do this many at once, but I'm just Anyone got any other favorites you want to throw in there? Amazon. What's the trading symbol? Do you know? AMZN. Whoops. Got to put a con. Anything else? That should be enough, I guess. Let's see what we get. We'll do daily returns on a 60-day roll. Here we go. Now, it's obviously it's a diagonal matrix. Top, the upper diagonal and the lower diagonal are below the diagonal and above the diagonal are the same, just reversed. So let's look. Target against Netflix, a 0.19. That's a low correlation coefficient. That's, in other words, these would help each other out. These would help your portfolio out, putting these two together, because they don't have a high correlation coefficient. Target against General Motors, a little higher, but still a low, still in that low range there. Target against Nordstrom. Yeah, obviously, you see why that is. I mean, it's some. Let me warn you about this. Sometimes you'll see correlation coefficients that's high, and there is no logic on earth why that should be like that. I've seen, I wish I could remember the two companies. I saw two companies totally unrelated. They had a Pearson correlation coefficient of like 0.70. And I thought, how in the hell? Just sometimes it's the nature of statistics, something like that oddity comes up. Okay, Target against Google. That's actually kind of surprising. That's getting up there into that worry territory. My worry is around 0.35. And that's above that. God knows. Target against Amazon, the whole thing, well, they're both retail, but one, their vectors for their sales are completely different. One's brick and mortar, one's online. So that is a very good pairing. And then you see Netflix against GM, that makes sense. Against Nordstrom, absolutely. Netflix against Microsoft and Google and Amazon. All online. Do you see how you're trying to load too much into the online and you're going to get a lot of correlation? You're not going to get that diversification that you wanted. You see that, right? Just the logic of it is there is a logic to this. And then GM against, now see that one, General Motors against Nordstrom. That's just a little weird to me. That's a little high. Like I said, and you have to find your own ouch. Mine's about 0.35. I can tolerate up to 0.4, but I don't like that. I love to see in the point below 0.3. But why those two would be hooked up like that? GM and Microsoft, GM and Google. It's quite correlated with those, but it is not correlated at all with Amazon. You might be able to figure out some explanation, whether your explanation is right or not. That's another thing entirely. Nordstrom against Microsoft? Yeah, obviously. Good God, Nordstrom against Amazon is a negative. That's great. That's really nice because they're literally not just damping each other, they're actually counteracting each other when you get a negative. That's a little bit odd. I wasn't expecting that there. That's very cool. Okay. Microsoft against Google, yeah. I mean, put those in the portfolio with Google and Amazon. Not a smart thing. Alphabet, yeah, that's Google against Amazon. Now, Amazon, just looking at it, if I were to have Amazon in a portfolio, I'd put it with Target, GM, Nordstrom, and I'd leave Microsoft and Google out. But if I had Microsoft in there, I wouldn't put Google. It's your call, but I mean, you're not getting portfolio diversification with those high correlation coefficients. That means you have to put more stocks into your portfolio. Every time you put in a round lot, that's going to cost you more money. You follow the idea here? So what I'm going to do is,
Target, Netflix, and Amazon.
I think I'll. Now, the next thing I'm going to show you here. Now, that's your first thing for building a portfolio. And remember, when you get these gurus on these shows, financial shows, well, I recommend that you buy some of this stock. That's simplistic child's advice. Because behind it, he's not talking about correlations. He's not talking about the individual characteristics of your portfolio at all. He doesn't give a rat's ass. And that's the heart and soul. Throwing something in, one thing that can be a real danger, you hear great things about some stock. Okay, I'm just going to throw that in my well-diversified portfolio. Just as a side bet, throw it in there. What happens if that son of a bitch is highly correlated with several of the stocks in your portfolio? You have actually just hurt your portfolio diversification by doing that. Throwing it in there without checking to make sure that it's not highly correlated with something, some of the stuff that's already in there, not a good idea. Okay, so now, I'm looking Target against Netflix. Good. Target against Amazon. Good. Target Netflix and Amazon. What I'm going to do is I'm going to make a three-stock portfolio. Show you the next thing. None of this is really high-powered math at all. It's just sort of like stuff you've seen before. But I'm going to do Target, Netflix, and Amazon. Now let me go back over here. Okay, let's go with Target. Okay, close 82.10. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a round lot of Target. That'll put a market value for the Target component of my portfolio at $8,210 at the end of today. So I'm going to have $8,210 in Target in my portfolio. And the beta of it is 0.54. Okay, so now the next one I'll look at is Netflix. NFLX. That's going to, a round lot of that is going to cost me $10,494. $494. With a beta on that one of 0.98. And finally, in this portfolio, I wanted to put some Amazon, throw in a round lot of Amazon. AMZN. Come on. Holy shit! Seriously? I don't look at these kinds of things. This is all new age stuff. Look at the beta of that thing, too. That's Amazon. A beta of 1.63? That's a yeehaw beta. Good God, if I were a rabbit, my back leg would be thumping right now. Okay, 58,000, a round lot of that's going to whack you $58,614. $58,614 in the portfolio. Okay, that's the market value. So the market value of Target is $8,210 in your portfolio. The market value at the end today of Netflix is $10,494. And the market value of the Amazon is $58,614. So if I were to add those up, I'd get the value of my portfolio at the end of today. It's a nice thing to be able to do if you're starting to invest in stocks, is just keep, you know, a track of on a daily basis. Don't sweat it. Don't get excited when it goes up and down. But just nice to have an idea of where you are on your portfolio. And if I were to honk those three numbers out together, just on a calculator, I'd have 8210 plus 10494 plus 58614. So my portfolio's total value is $77,318. Well, the next thing that you want to do is you want to calculate the weights in the portfolio of each one. How much of your portfolio is weighted on each one? So in order to do that, I would need to take for target 8210 divided by the 77318. And I would want to take for the Netflix the 10,494 divided by the 77318. And for the Amazon, I would want to take $58,614 divided by the 77318 total value. Now, doing that real quick here, I'm going to store that in memory. And I'm going to then go ahead and I'm going to take 8210 divided by that total value. And I get that the target is about 10.62% of the portfolio. The Netflix at 10,494 divided by the total value of the portfolio is 13.57% of the portfolio. And the Amazon at 58,614 divided by the memory recall dominates the portfolio at 75.81%. Okay. Here's why I care about that. I'm going to flip you over here for a second to the document camera. Here's why that matters to you. Because what I can do now is I can calculate the beta of my portfolio. It's really simple. It's just a weighted average of these. So in other words, what I do is I take the beta of target, 0.54 times 0.1062 plus the beta of Netflix, 0.98 times 0.1357 plus the beta of Amazon. What was that? I didn't write it down. 1.64 times its weight in the portfolio, 0.7581. And this way, I can now say what my portfolio beta is. It's 0.54 times 0.1062 plus 0.98 times 0.1352 plus 1.64 times 0.7581. The beta of my portfolio is 1.43. Here's the last point about this. Now, obviously, I'm sure almost all of you could set up an Excel sheet that could do this a lot faster than I was doing by hand, but I wanted to show you just the mechanics of it. Last point about this. Notice how Amazon dominates the portfolio. dominates the value of the portfolio, dominates the risk of the portfolio. Google, companies like Google, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon is in that league too. A handful of companies, maybe 100 or so, constitute so much of the market that in order to build a portfolio, you really have to work hard not to avoid these essentially monopolies or these oligopolies. A long time ago, before your time, before my time, in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, laws were passed to stop monopolies from coming into being. Regulatory agencies were set up to watch over companies, make sure they didn't get too big. Well, we gave up on that back in the 80s. And in the 90s, we really gave up on it. The president in the 90s was what is sometimes called politically a neoliberal, harkening back to the time in the 1960s when we believed that actually large companies were a good thing because that was the best way to guarantee a strong presence on the world stage economically and militarily. But now we've got this situation where in finance, portfolios essentially are driven by just a handful of companies. And everyone else is sort of like tagging along, just sort of running with the crowd. Let me show you how serious it is. Let me show you. I'm going to take something here. Clear this out. X here. And market cap, keep that in mind, about $2.75 billion. Let's take Google. Market cap 5. So we're up to about 7.5, around there. Now let's take Apple. Whoops. Did I do that wrong? Apple. There's another 6.08, so we're now at about 1.3 trillion. And one more, let's just throw in Microsoft. So we're now up to about 1.7 trillion. Now I'm going to do something kind of fun. Now, I want to do this, the next link. Not getting it here either. Somehow it doesn't like what I'm doing. Really, really, oh, there it is. Is that it? There we go. Rank. I think I did five companies. Those five companies together constitute, as a single entity, is about the ninth largest country in the world, those five companies, beating out Canada. That is the distortion as a finance person and as you as an investor have to face, is that essentially those giants taken together, your portfolio is going to have them in it, and they are going to determine the fate, not just of your portfolio. They'll drive the risk, they'll drive the value of it, those five together, but they'll also eventually drive the fate of the world, because eventually they'll get up there to rank around number one, and that will be when we have Jeff Bezos as our new president or something like that. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.